history makers. England are European champions again. They've defended their crown successfully. Back-to-back triumphs for the young Lions.
Chloe Kelly is staying home. The legendary Lionesses.
Hello and welcome to a new season of the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever I am joined by Jan Dalton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Yes, another season. Yet another season. You cannot get rid of us. We just carry on. Nothing stops us, does it, Terry?
Nothing so far, Graham, has stopped us. No, apart from perhaps the listener pressing unsubscribe, which they shouldn't do.
No, they shouldn't do.
Do not do that.
No matter how tempting. Even if you're a new one and thinking, oh, is this really what I want to listen to? I mean, I want to broaden my horizons with my football podcast listening. And you should. And you should do that. We know you have a choice. And thank you for choosing us on this occasion. Jan, what sort of stuff can the new listeners expect from us? How would you sum up the Sound of Football experience, say, compared to, say, other football podcasts that you might listen to?
I would say what differentiates us from the other podcasts is that we don't really talk about a great deal of football, do we?
We tend
to talk about the stuff that surrounds it, the stuff that orbits football. So if you're interested in hearing about, you know, how Arsenal or Sheffield Wednesday or, God forbid, Newcastle got on at the weekend, then there's plenty of shows for you out there. But this isn't the one we go in for. More interesting, I think, more topical stuff. And stuff that hopefully gets you thinking.
That was a good summary, wasn't it, Terry? Would you agree with that? Or would you describe it in another way?
No, I would say that that's pretty fair. I mean, we do discuss football results, and we do also foreshadow and preview football results. What we don't do, however, is we don't make predictions. There are often situations where we would find ourselves unsurprised by something happening in football, but we certainly wouldn't make a prediction. But we do offer previews, and we do occasionally discuss. We will talk about actual football and football results, but our emphasis, yes, Jan's analysis is right. We like to look at the business of football. I've been started listening to a different podcast.
Hang on.
Well, the thing is that my number of football podcasts I have listened to over the last few years has shrunk quite a lot. And there are only a few that I listen to. But I started listening to one by a number of luminaries, the real sort of like football hipster royalty. And they're really, really good. It's really, really good. But their kind of approach is very, very familiar. It's possible one or more of the number might actually, in the past, have actually listened to us because we've been around that long, and so have they. They do tend to focus on the sort of like stuff around football. So if you like that podcast, then you'll like this one. The difference with them is obviously they are paid professional journalists, and they spend their entire waking hours basically thinking about football because it's their job, whereas we are, you know, independently incomed and don't do that. But what occurred to me when I was listening to it, and it's rather sad, actually, and I don't wish to be downbeat, but they sound like a bunch of guys who are actually presiding over the end of their industry, that being the football journalism industry. Not all the time, but there are moments when you're listening to it. I thought about that with us, and I wondered whether or not sometimes that's us from time to time, because we do take adversarial views on a lot of changes that have happened in the modern game, not least of which is VAR, but there are others as well. We're going to discuss one of those right now. And there are times when I do wonder whether or not we are presiding over the sort of like death of a type of football that in a few years' time will not be the same, that the game is changing to the point where it's becoming almost unrecognizable. But anyway, I suppose that's a theme that perhaps we can explore over the oncoming months. But we do so with humour and a no small amount of sarcasm and with a real love and passion for the game. So I hope that if you are new to the podcast that you'll stick with us, and hopefully we'll offer some kind of insight, or if nothing else, a slightly different way of looking at things.
Yes. I wonder if it's actually more of a general conceit of every generation that they always believe that they live in interesting times, that historians will look back at the age in which we live and think, wow, what a time to be alive that would have been, all that stuff going on, when really most ages are quite dull as far as history is concerned. Is this the end of days of football? Probably not. We've been saying that for the last 16 years, and it's still going, despite what we've been saying.
I wasn't suggesting football was dying, but I guess our sort of like football, if you like, perhaps dare I say our generation sort of like, you know, football and what we were is passing, and because things change.
Things do change.
There are those who think, well, that's a good thing. But we've seen the Club World Cup come along. We've seen the rise of women's football. Things are changing for the bad and things are changing for the good. And we are here to discuss them.
Well, let's start discussing it. Let's stop navel gazing and welcome new listeners, by the way. We're going to start actually talking about stuff we talk about now. This is it. Oh, 37 episodes between now and the end of the season. Oh, yeah. Great. Got to stretch up.
And no ad breaks.
And no ad breaks at all. Well, except for ones. Yeah. Well, okay. Yes. Except no ad breaks at all. But what we'll do is we'll start off talking about all the football that happened over the summer, because a lot of football happened over the summer and we were glued to it, weren't we? I mean, I went over to Switzerland. Terry went over to Switzerland as well. And Jan, there was the Club World Cup. I mean, you must have watched all of that, didn't you? I mean, it was on Channel 5 and everything.
Yes, it was, Graham. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Terry, you must have really consumed it. Chelsea won it. There you go. You didn't even have to look that up, did you?
No, I didn't have to look that up. But in fairness, though, I did actually watch the Chelsea winning of the Club World Cup, because the final started so late that it finished much, much later than the England game that I was actually watching on the other side. I looked at my phone and went, oh, that Club World Cup final is still going on. I thought it started at the same time as the England game, and it says here they're only 60 minutes in, so I switched over to watch it. I mean, it was all over by that, apparently, Chelsea, because obviously Chelsea won the game in the first half. I watched that, and I think I watched Bayern Munich beat Auckland City 10-0. When I say watched, I think I had it on the television and thought, well, this is a bit of a shit show, isn't it, guys? I think the subtext of your question, Graham, is that actually we didn't watch the Club World Cup.
No, of course we didn't watch the Club World Cup. And maybe, listen, you come from a part of the world where you think actually this was an important competition, but it wasn't. This is our first service for you for the season, is to tell you that it wasn't an important competition. It was just a sham. It was flim-flam. That's all it was. Yeah, Channel 5 probably did all right out of it, I suppose. I mean, what else were they going to show? Nazi megastructures? Actually, that would have been pretty cool. I would have watched that. Yeah,
I would have definitely watched that. I had a very similar experience to Terry in that I saw the final, saw bits of the final. But the game that I thought I'd be interested in seeing was, as you say, Terry, the Bayern-Auckland one. And I was doing something else at the time when it started. I went, oh, I'll get to that. And then my phone kept buzzing and buzzing and buzzing. And after about 10 minutes, I think they were about 5-0 up. So I put it on and watched it till quarter past the hour and went, there's nothing to watch here. There really is nothing to watch. And that was the last time I engaged with the Club World Cup, save for the final.
Well, I think we should wrap up our Club World Cup chat now. We will come back to it, because obviously we're going to be talking about FIFA and all that sort of stuff. And Bull FIFA guy will be a recurring subject throughout the whole season, as he always is. But we'll just park it for now, because quite frankly, there was nothing worth talking about there. Well, as far as I was concerned anyway. And again, international listeners, you may not like the next segment as well, because next bit is us like bigging up how great England is. Because England, not only did they win the women's Euros, they also won the men's under-21s as well, both of which were retained by those teams. Terry, it's all coming up England, isn't it?
Certainly in certain categories of England football, yeah, it is definitely coming up. This is England's time. I mean, you know, getting to the final of the men's Euros, albeit losing, but getting to the final is a great achievement. And then retaining the Euros under-21 men's title is a fantastic achievement and not done very often. And the Lionesses, I think, frankly, that's the jewel in the crown. I mean, that was an extraordinary story and a fantastic achievement. Especially given that for large parts of the knockout stages, it looked like they were second best to almost everyone, and yet demonstrated tremendous resilience and fortitude to be able to come through. and win that tournament and win it on penalties as well, showing tremendous guts as well. A real champion's grit, it's got to be said. I don't think that they were the best team in the tournament, but best teams don't always win tournaments. And you also have to be able to have and demonstrate the bottle and class to be able to see through a result. I think England were able to do that where other teams weren't able to do that. And it was tremendous in what was a extremely entertaining tournament as well. The best. They get every passing Euro women's international tournament gets better. With every 2 years, they get better and better and better. And I imagine that that will be the case for a few years to come as well.
Yes, it was an astounding tournament. I had a great time out there. I was there for the knockout stages. Terry was out there for a couple of days in the group stages. And it was just, all right, it was horrifically expensive out there, but smoothly run. You could see where all the money had gone, put it that way. Everything was just on rails out there. Sometimes literally, free transport getting to the ground, lovely. All was great. The only mad bit were the actual games. They were the insane bits. And being in the stadium for that Sweden game and the Italy game was memories that will stick for a very, very long time. They were fantastic experiences. And of course, as well, yes, as I mentioned, the under-21s retained their title as well, which is also another big achievement for England and the whole setup of England. Jan, it's weird now. I don't know how your kids see England now, the whole setup of England, but they must just be used to like England getting to finals all the time, men and women. I mean, not the men still aren't winning things, but they're always there, aren't they? They're all getting to like the semi-finals and the finals. Is it just us now that think that England are just big letdowns?
I think probably, and I think our age
yes.
has something to do with that. If you've lived through the 80s and the 90s, or you even remember the 90s, which I can't help you with, that you know England just weren't very good. And well, that's maybe not so fair because you know they had some heroic failures across that period, but nothing to the they didn't achieve the dizzy heights. And I'm talking about the men's team here. They didn't achieve the dizzy heights that they have of late. That's quite interesting. My son is 17, so he's, you know, since he got into football, England have been a pretty good men's side. But what's been really good, I think, is that I've been able to talk to my daughter, she's a tiny little bit younger, about football because she's been interested in watching the England women's team. And she came along with me to a women's game with, I think it was the end of the season before last, when Sunderland played at Palace, when Palace got promoted. So it is bringing people into football that otherwise wouldn't have been interested in football. And that applies to both men's and women's football. So I think it's a really good thing. It is a good thing. Starting to regret renouncing my English citizenship now, because Ireland have won absolutely nothing since I moved over. So there you go. Yeah.
Coincidence, Terry? I think not.
Design, Graham.
Well, I'm sure the success of England is also going to be something that we'll return to. And obviously, we've got a build-up to a World Cup coming up at the end of this season as well, haven't we? So that's something to look forward to, isn't it, lads? And that's going to be something that we're going to be discussing at length, I'm sure. But let's get things back to this season. Let's start talking about the big news events. We love nothing more on this podcast than a story that breaks around Monday lunchtime. Monday lunchtime, if you can got a story that drops then, mwah, 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 mwah. We love that, don't we? And we were lucky enough to have a story like that. And we knew it was coming. We knew this decision was coming on Monday lunchtime. So it was great that it fell in our lap. Not so great was the actual announcement, which, Terry, you better pick this one up. What was the announcement that came out today?
Crystal Palace lost their appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport for their relegation to the Conference League from the Europa League. Yeah, that's the story. They fell foul of UEFA's multi-club ownership rules and they appealed the decision and CAS went, nope, you still fall foul of UEFA's multi-club ownership rules and no, I'm sorry, we're not overturning that decision. And so Palace will, instead of participating in the Europa League, which would have been great, they will participate in the Conference League, which will probably still be great.
It probably will be, and it's probably a competition that they could well win. Because they're a decent team and they win stuff.
I mean, the bigger story is Crystal Palace won the Community Shield yesterday. For me, that's the bigger story. That's the biggest story. That, I mean, that is a competition that they've never participated in because they've never won anything until last May. Gratifying to receive messages from Liverpool supporting friends conceding that Palace won the day and deserved it on the balance of play, and deserved it certainly on the balance of the penalty shootout. So, which was very, very nice. No Scousers complaining about losing, which that's a nice feeling. You know you've played well when that doesn't happen. That's the really big story, I think. But obviously, you know, perhaps in a broader sense, there's, and perhaps in terms of, you know, of discussion, I think it is significant that Palace tried to get this decision overturned. But at the same time, I think it's also, it highlights, I think, the inequities in UEFA's laws. But it also highlights the fact that you do have to abide by those laws, as long as it, as unjust as they may be, you do have to abide by them. And you do have to get your necessary paperwork in on time if you want to participate in this competition. And I'm afraid that Crystal Palace just didn't do that. And that is why they found themselves in the position where they were having to, you know, rather than nurse a hangover after celebrating the Community Shield win, they had to drag their asses to Lausanne to listen to the Court of Arbitration for Sport say, no. I don't want to be unkind about Palace, but at the same time, you know, I think this is something that could have been avoided. And I think it's really a case of a plague on all their houses, really.
Yeah, I did actually see someone walking around town with one of those UEFA Mafia T-shirts that quite a few people were wearing at Wembley yesterday. Obviously, the unofficial Palace shops have been doing well getting those out. But it's really a story in which no one comes out looking well. The rules have been highlighted as a complete farce, the rules that have been put in place. We spoke at the end of last season about whether or not getting an extra spot should be given to the cup winners because of UEFA's own rules that say that the domestic cup winner is the highest ranked Europa League qualifier, which obviously isn't the case. It's been shown up as this because now you've got Lyon, who were qualified for the Conference League and were bumped up, not because of what they did, but because of PSG beating Rennes in the French Cup final. So
indeed,
you've got Lyon being promoted into a competition and Palace being demoted out of a competition for no other reason other than the fact that they didn't do their paperwork properly. And that's the insane thing. It's not about multi-club ownership because, as we've seen, there is lots and lots and lots of multi-club ownership. It's just how you do your admin, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you've got a multi-club ownership situation and you're likely to qualify for the same European tournament next season, then one of the clubs has to put the shares of the multi-club owner. So in this instance, it's a gentleman called John Textor, who had majority shares in Palace and in Lyon. He has to put his shares into a blind trust on either one of those clubs. Evangelos Raonakis did the same thing with Nottingham Forest. Red Bull, City Football Group. Believe it or not, Manchester United, the classic rake steppers themselves, even they managed to do this with Nice so that they could participate in the Europa League. This is something that should have been organised. Now, you can argue that maybe Lyon should have sorted this out or John Textor should have sorted this out. But really, ultimately, you know, if it's a stated aim of the club to win the FA Cup, and it was, as unlikely as it may have been, it was a stated aim of the club to win the FA Cup last season. And really, Steve Parish should have said, even if he couldn't do it himself, he should have been saying, banging on John Texas' door or what happened, say, look, we need to get our ducks in a row. So in the happy event that we do win the FA Cup, that we are ready to participate in the competition that we qualify for. For me, that is a lack of foresight. It might well be that he might have been able to have tried to have done that and then failed. But it's unlikely because I think, to be honest with you, I think it took him by surprise. So there's that side of it that's also very disappointing. So, you know, there's nothing you can say to me that tells me that Maranakis does not own Nottingham Forest and Olympiacos. And had Forest qualified for the Champions League, Forest would still have been able to have played in the Champions League along with Olympiacos because he put his shares of Forest into a blind trust. This is the same guy who's able to walk down onto the pitch at the end of a game, remonstrate with his coach, and walk around the place like he owns it because he does still own it. even though technically speaking, his shares are in a blind trust. So that is an illustration of it. When you see Jurgen Klopp, the global head of everything, sauntering around and taking his places at the nicest possible seats, all the Red Bull stadiums, that is because Red Bull have direct involvement in all of those clubs. So there is nothing you can say to me that Red Bull Salzburg and Red Bull Leipzig are not directly affected and controlled by Red Bull. It's just that they are able to get their paperwork in time. The biggest crime in UEFA's eyes is not being under multi-club ownership. It's not getting your paperwork in time, which, of course, for an administrative body like UEFA, is an absolute heinous crime. And for a club like Crystal Palace, it's probably a day-to-day occurrence.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree with more with what you've said. You've said that it is quite damning and sad that a club misses out on that level of European football because of an admin error, which is what it is. And to be fair, Crystal Palace, well, somebody at Crystal Palace needs to be crucified for that, because we shouldn't even be talking about this. I completely understand the frustration of everyone involved in this, and especially my friends who are Palace fans. But on the other side of it, I look at this and just go, well, you know, you knew the rules in the game you were playing, and those rules are hard and fast, and they're admin rules. And to be honest with you, there can't be much to complain about. I hear all the arguments that Graham went through with all the other clubs, but it is what it is. And Palace could have got around this, and they didn't. So this is where they find themselves.
Everyone else got around it.
I think the way that UEFA have calculated where these extra places go is flawed. I think whole thing about multi-club ownership, the whole thing about blind trust, is massively flawed. And hopefully what this whole thing does is highlight how terrible the whole situation is and how people should say, no, this doesn't work. The trouble is, so many clubs now have owners who own parts of other football clubs. Why? I don't know. And maybe this is something we'll have to a whole episode on. Why on earth would you have more than one club? It just sounds like a ridiculous thing to do anyway. Well, I know exactly why people do it. It's because they just use it to funnel players around, which just makes it even worse. There is no legitimate reason to own more than one football club. Well, none that I can think of anyway. And hopefully this whole incident brings it home. Well, I hope so anyway.
You know, the decision's now been made, and that is it. Palace will be playing in the Conference League, and that is fine. That is actually fine. I'm very happy with that. If you'd said to me at this time last year, Terry, next year your team will be playing in the Conference League, I'd have said, yes, I'll take that. Thank you very much. And I am very happy with that. But if there is talk about maybe taking this further in the courts, you know, that's something that if they want to pursue that, then fair play to them. And I hope that they do pursue that. And I hope that they win, because, you know, this does need to be looked at. You know, I think that UEFA needs to come up with more honest rules about MCOs and just say, well, we've got to do anything about it. Or they'll say, no, actually, you know, we're going to have to start banning this. We're going to have to be really, really clear. A Red Bull, only one of your teams can play in the Champions League. You have to decide which one it is, but only one of them can be. City Football Group, absolutely same. Maranakis, absolutely same. Ineos, absolutely same with you. Palace are now no longer owned by John Textor and are now no longer multi-club. That's the other ironic thing, of course, is that but none of this happened before March the 1st or April the 30th or April, depending on what the actual deadline was. And it's all a complete and utter shambles. The reason why multi-club ownership exists is the same reason why all companies merge, is because that they are looking to find more ways of extracting as much value out of their assets as they possibly can. And that is why multi-club ownership is there. It is symptomatic of late-stage capitalism. And so that is why they're doing it. It's not a good way of doing it, and it's terrible. And it goes back to what we were talking about, presiding over the end of football. But that is ultimately why they do it. That's not why they say they do it, but that is ultimately why they do it. It's the same reason why Paramount and Skydance merged. Money.
Economies of scale.
Yes.
It also stinks of being a bit of a status symbol or a plaything for millionaires to say I've got a club in Greece where I'm from and I've got loads of money. So look at me. I own the big club here. And I also own a club in the Premier League, to use one example there. Or if you're a state that wants to sports wash its reputation, then if you've got a club in the Premier League and you've got a club in La Liga, then that's also going to help as well. So it is. There's many, many reasons for it. None of them fit with the purity and the spirit of the game that it, as it was intended. But there you go. As you say, Terry, we're presiding over the end of days.
At least, I mean, like, what you should be able to do if you want to own more than one club is just get some kind of puppet venture capital business run by a supposed American billionaire and then do crazy, crazy stuff in the transfer firm market while you own another club up in the Northeast. I mean, that, at least you should do that.
At least they're trying, aren't they?
Did I say that out loud? Whoops.
I think you might have done. Yeah.
Well, I think there is a silver lining in this, because I think Palace can actually win the Conference League. I mean, let's face it, West Ham won this, so you should be able to win it. Mind you, saying that, Tottenham won the Europa League, so you probably would have won that as well.
If last year's Tottenham could win the Europa League, then why can't this year's Palace? But yeah, I think that there's a really good chance that we have a playoff. That's the other irksome thing, is that we've got to go through a playoff, whereas before we just dropped straight into the group stage. So we've got to go to, I can't remember the name of the team, they're a team in Norway that we've got to play. I mean, we should be heavy favourites over two legs to win that. But it's our first ever European tie, and it's Palace. So you never know.
You never know.
But if we get into the group stage, then yeah, I would demand that we go quite deep in that competition.
Yeah, it's a shorter group stage as well in the Conference League. I think it still is anyway. Last season it was only 6 games instead of 8 games. And I think if it's your first season in Europe as well, I think that's probably not a bad way to ease your way in, because European football does mean a lot more football. Yeah, and Palace do seem to have an interest now in going deep in cup competitions as well.
Yep. Palace are a trophy-winning team at the moment. That's the mentality. They've gone from being a team that wants to stay in the Premier League to being a team that wants to win trophies. It's a shame that you know, and I'm going to say this, it's a shame that I think that Steve Parrish, I don't think, fully believes that himself. But the guy he employed to be his manager clearly believes that and has so far delivered emphatically on that belief. Hmm. So I think it's time that Steve Parrish needs maybe just a slight attitude adjustment.
I wonder, because Palace haven't really invested in their team over the close season, have they, too much? I think they brought in a couple of players. But are they going to be able to cope with those additional games? Even if they are smaller teams in Norway, that the games are going to get progressively harder as you get deeper into the competition, and you've still got your domestic calendar to fulfill. So what's your thoughts on that, Terry?
Well, I think that we probably will let Mark Gahey go, possibly to Liverpool. And then I would like to think that they'll bring in a couple of players towards the end of this transfer window. They said they wouldn't do that, but they're going to, because we are almost at the end of the transfer window and the season is almost upon. I mean, yeah, it could all go disastrously wrong because it is Crystal Palace, but there are quite a few teams in the Premier League that are worse than Palace, certainly more than three. And so we could be looking at a finishing 12th and then going deep in a cup competition again scenario, which is a desirable outcome, in my opinion, because going deep in cup competitions is fun. Everybody thinks that's fun. I mean, unless you're really looking to actually do something meaningful in the Premier League, like qualify for the Champions League or win it, then, you know, as long as you're safe, then I think you prioritise those knockout games and try and win some more silverware, because it's great. Can confirm. Winning stuff is great.
Well, Jan, you did finish the season quite jubilantly on our last podcast of the season. We were all very, very happy. Everyone was a winner. And I said, well, you know, next season's going to be all a bit, isn't it? You're going to be getting humped every week.
But that's for Jan next season to worry about, because Jan this season is full of beans and all happy.
Well,
here we are.
You know that? Do you know that last season, Jan?
Yeah.
He's a fucking idiot. Because here I am a week before we play. You know, this is exactly what I was saying before I became that awful individual. That my concern was, we're playing West Ham in the opening day of the season, and West Ham finished just above Spurs and Man United, which was pretty low without getting relegated, wasn't it? As low as you can go without getting relegated. And we faced the prospect of just being humped by them. So lower mid-table sides are going to see the newly promoted sides, despite the fact that they've spent flipping great wadges of cash since they got promoted, all of the sides, Sun particularly. And this is what I was dreading before the euphoria of the playoff final, was the, you know, playing sides like that and just getting spanked. I also said, but he also said as well, that the model that Sunderland employ, and I can see my colleague on the South Coast giggling away and enjoying this particularly, probably a little bit too much, but the model that Sunderland were married to since Kyle Louis-Dreyfus came in as owner and chairman, was that we bought cheap and we bought good quality prospects for the future. And I didn't think that Sunderland were going to break from that. And I was concerned that this season, Jan, was going to have to deal with a team that went up woefully inadequately prepared for that, which may well still be the case, but we spent £130 odd million. Again, proving my opening point that last season's Jan is an idiot. But it's been interesting. Bellingham went, which we were expecting, for a good chunk, £30 million to Dortmund. And Tom Watson, who got us promoted with that wonderful goal in the 95th minute against Sheffield United, went the next day. It was pretty great. But since then, we've brought in 10 or 11 players, one of whom is Granit Xhaka, which I didn't think that we would, and I'm being serious now, I didn't think we'd suddenly ever have a player of that quality. And I know he is advanced his years somewhat, but he's still 31, 32, played in Germany for Leverkusen and was part of the championship winning side, or the Bundesliga winning side, and you know, remains to be a quality, dare I say, world-class player. Some of the other players we've brought in have played at high levels across Europe. But I don't know how they're going to all bond, because we've effectively bought a new team. And I know we've seen this before. I think the only bit of optimism I'll allow myself is that when you look at Forest, who we mentioned earlier, when they came up, they spent £130, £140 million and they stayed up by the skin of their teeth. But they've bought twice as many players that Sunderland have bought so far. So it was always going to be a little bit more chaotic for them. Not saying it's not going to be chaotic for Sunderland, but I think, and it seems, and it feels like that Sunderland have invested wisely, and that they have a good chance, or a better than awful chance, which is where I thought we were going to be, of doing something special. By which I mean, finishing ahead of where Manchester United did last season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on reflection, it feels to me that they must have had a short list of players that they were going to sign in the event that they won the playoff final. The other thing that occurs to me is that they were preparing for the playoffs some weeks in advance, because they knew they were going to be in the playoffs. So they, you know, rested players, and they really got themselves ready for that postseason tournament, and went, right, those that actually, it doesn't matter whether how many games we lose between now and the end of the season, because we're in the playoffs, we've qualified for the playoffs. It's the final three games of the season, the ones that really, really matter. And albeit by the skin of their teeth, they've succeeded and they've done it. And I suspect that they probably thought, right, okay, plan A is we lose the playoff final, because plan B is that we've got a list of players for promotion to the Premier League. And so depending on what happens in the playoff final, we go with plan A or plan B. And that's what's happened. And they've been able to put in the money. They do have money. They've been able to offset somewhat by Joe Bellingham's transfer to Dortmund, and indeed Tom Watson as well. So I think they've really planned it extremely well, and they look targeted. It just feels like they know what they're doing. And the reason for that, I think, is the timing of them. You know, they've done all this business in the first few weeks. We're not even halfway through August, and Sunderland are set. I mean, I think there is actually another guy coming in, but they seem to be set. You know, whereas everyone else, I think, is going to be scrabbling around in the final 2 weeks of the season for bargains to try and force the money down. Whereas Sunderland have gone, we know these players that we want to sign. These are what we're going to sign. And they've done them. And they may well have actually already done some work ahead in order to get these signings done. Because, you know, there's been no haggling over price. They've just said, right, boom, boom, boom. And it all just seems to be efficient and ordered. You know, things that you have customarily in years gone by, you've not associated with Sunderland. It's all quite impressive. It could all fall apart against West Ham at the weekend, but it feels now that, you know, they've had a great window. No, they've given themselves a really good chance of staying up, I think.
I think it's a really good point about how organised and focused they've been since Kyle Louis-Dreyfus came in. well, certainly if you just look at the last couple of seasons when in the Championship, Sunderland made money, only a little bit, but they made money in the Championship before getting promoted. So they were in a position where they can go, well, look, we've got all of this money coming to us. Even if we come straight back down, we can afford to give it a go because we're in the black anyway. It felt like the foundation was laid, certainly was built upon once the ownership changed, and is completely night and day to, if you remember, you know, the nightmare years at the end of Ellis Short's reign, where Sunderland just plunged through the divisions, where you had an owner who was an absentee but agreed to keep the lights on. And it just feels like we are being serious about it now, and it may well fail, but I completely agree. I think it feels like, it looks like, and it sounds like a really well-run operation. So let's see how it pans itself out. It's going to be fucking awful, isn't it?
It's going to be like a massive shit show. But anyway.
Well, we'll see. This game against West Ham, you know, it's West Ham. When have they ever fly out the blocks? Come on.
What, come on, a full pre-season under Brian Potter? No.
Yeah. Well, Terry, I guess we should talk about Jude Bellingham going to Dortmund. That's an interesting move, isn't it?
It was discussed when he was at Birmingham and when Jude was still at Dortmund. There were some renewed reports in Germany about how Dortmund were looking at him, and I think Jude was quite keen for him to join them. I mean, obviously the Bellingham family is quite tight-knit. They look after their own affairs. They've clearly got a very good relationship with Dortmund. You know, if from that point of view, it makes some sense. It's interesting that Jude didn't leave Dortmund under a cloud, but I mean, I think that he had maybe put a couple of guys' noses out of joint in the Dortmund dressing room. No, it has nothing to do, obviously, with Job. Job is probably a very different guy. But he came in and slotted in to the team because he was signed in time for the Club World Cup, and they played him. I've no idea how it went because I didn't watch the Club World Cup. But, I mean, from what I understand, he's done very well. It might be that, again, that familiarity and that relationship prior to him arriving anyway, that he had through his brother. So that's a tremendously good fit. Now, all they now need to do is to sign Jadon Sancho just get the gang back together again. That'd be terrific.
Yeah, as Erling Haaland got a little brother who they can sign as well.
No, but I understand Alexander Isak is looking for a new club though. So, you know, who knows? Maybe get that. Because Sancho and Isak kind of made their debut. I think they both made their full debuts together against Wolfsburg. I may have that slightly wrong, but I think maybe they both had their first starts both together. Isak, obviously, both went on to, interestingly, because Sancho had a, why am we talking about history? Sancho had a great career at Dortmund. Isak didn't. And then Sancho's career's gone right down the toilet since he left. Isak has gone from strength to strength since he left Dortmund. So really interesting. Anyway, sorry, that is massively nothing to do with what we're talking about. So.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point, though. It is very much an interesting point. And is it one worth finishing on? Maybe not, but still. Time has defeated us, I'm afraid. So how we usually finish an episode, though, is to talk about what's coming up at the weekend, because I usually lead in with some rather strained segue and to say, but what will we be watching this weekend, I wonder? And so what will we be watching this weekend, I wonder? Because the Premier League's back and there's loads of games on over the weekend, starting with Liverpool versus Bournemouth. There's also Chelsea versus Palace on Sunday afternoon, and the small matter of Manchester United Arsenal as well. How's that for a first game of the season? Wow, that'll be a shit show up at Old Trafford. And on Saturday night, we've got Valencia versus Real Sociedad on Disney Plus. Yeah, if you've got Disney Plus, this is going to be your new home for late evening La Liga action.
On a Saturday?
On a Saturday, yeah. If you're sad and you don't go out, which is probably why you've got Disney Plus, because you don't go out and you've got no social life, now you can sit at home and watch some Spanish football. That's great, isn't it, Jan?
It is great. I'm sad I have no life and I have Disney Plus, so I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, I too have no life and have Disney Plus, and I'm looking forward to that as well. Worth bearing in mind, Disney Plus have got the rights for the Women's Champions League as well.
Yeah,
in the UK.
They are moving into football, which obviously, like, because they do own ESPN, this is not new for them, is it really? So it's
Not at all.
So what actually happens, new listeners, is that all these games that we've just mentioned will appear in our newsletter, the weekend box set. The seven games we think you should be watching from Friday to Sunday. Yeah, seven games. We write a little preview for them, and then you decide which ones you want to watch. And if you want to watch all of them, then good for you. Good for you. That's a hell of a lot of football. So if you want to see what we think of those games, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and subscribe. It's on Substack as well, so you can probably find it on there, and you can subscribe through that. And it'll be in your inbox on Friday lunchtime-ish. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFellin, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now!
Terry's always clear.
I try and be as specific and precise as possible. Yeah, thank you.
Podcaster of note. And talented writer. And my chum.
This is just marvellous. You can definitely use this. Better be in the Easter egg, otherwise I'm leaving in disgust.